Dr. R.J. Rushduni, RR101C6, Irrational Man, Epistemology.
I've listed a name here, Fyodor Dostoevsky, a novel, The Possessed. Those few who have a more literary bent may find this of interest, because Dostoevsky, while we cannot call him an Orthodox Christian, he was Russian Orthodox, very, very defective, might be questionable whether we could call him a redeemed man, nonetheless, was sharply aware and presented in this novel the implications of a denial of God for man. The title Possessed literally should have been translated, but the English translators are not too theologically self-conscious, as the demon possessed. And Dostoevsky in this novel was portraying the demon-possessed students, the radical, atheistic, socialist students with their desires to create a revolution. And he felt, of course, that the world was going to be taken over by these demon-possessed men, and that the world was in for a fearful time until it returned to the faith. Now, the relevance of this book to our subject is that he shows these students with an epistemological self-consciousness, self-consciously denying everything. And therefore, it might be very worthwhile to analyze what Dostoevsky has to say, contrast it to the modern scene, the modern student, and, of course, in terms of Van Til's A Christian Theory of Knowledge, which, as I stated, is in your library. Our subject today is Irrational Man. Irrational Man. As we have seen, man in the modern world began by viewing himself in Descartes as pure thinking substance. But he now, after Darwin, regards himself at best as an irrational animal. The consequences of this change are everywhere with us. Man who at the beginning saw himself as a kind of a little god now sees himself as a debased animal. Van Til has commented with regard to the Arminian view of the mind of man as independent of any ultimate decree of God that, and I quote, Arminianism has been untrue to the biblical point of view with respect to this matter. We usually think of Arminianism, first of all, with respect to its denial of the biblical teaching of the sinner's ethical inability. However, back of the error of Arminianism at this point lies the error to which we are now calling attention. Namely, that it starts with a human consciousness as an ultimate instead of a derivative starting point. Arminianism has, in principle, denied the biblical concept of creation. This is its basic error and the source of all its other errors. So, for instance, Professor Donald McKenzie, in his article on free will, in the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, says that the trouble with Augustinianism and Calvinism is that it has started with the idea of an absolute God and deduced the doctrine of decrees from it, while in reality we should start from experience and adjust the concept of the absoluteness of God's grace as best we can to it. It is this assumption of human experience as an ultimate starting point that has now led him into the further error of the acceptance of modern irrationalism in the form of paradox theology, unquote. Now the consequences of this kind of thinking is that when you deny the sovereignty of God and his eternal decree, you deny ultimately that a system is possible. You cannot have, then, know any systematic theology. Now let us explain this before we go further. The only way you can have a systematic theology is if you have a God who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. God says, I am the Lord, I change not. When you have such a God, you can systematically say, here is God, and because God is eternally true to himself, we can therefore say these things because his word is truth, and God is true to himself, so that you can formulate propositions. You can have propositional truth. Now, this is not possible if God, as with Karl Barth, is characterized by freedom. Now, what does Barth mean by the freedom of God? For Karl Barth, God can be the opposite today of what he was yesterday. It might be valid for God to say, thou shalt not kill or commit adultery one time, and he can change later. Moreover, basic to an idea of systematics is an absolute self-consciousness and potentiality and actuality being one. Thus, to be ridiculous, let us say you are going to try to work out a systematics of R.J. Rushdoony. Now the idea is absurd, because what is there that you can say about me that would be the same yesterday, today, and forever, so that you could consistently chart everything about me and develop systematic propositional truths about me? Well, it couldn't be done. For example, we do not have a coincidence as human beings of potentiality and actuality, do we? There are potentialities in me that I may never realize until heaven. In heaven, my potentiality and actuality will be one. But it will be the potentiality and actuality of a creature. So, there's no systematics possible where I am concerned. Even though I am, I think, a very disciplined person, and my wife says she can tell in advance what I'm going to say when she asks me something, so she says sometimes she doesn't know why she bothers to ask. Still, we cannot say that you can derive propositional statements without fail from my being, or declare that you can develop the systematics of R.J. Rushdoony. It's impossible. But when you have an absolute predestinating God who is eternally true to himself, then you have systematic theology, and then only. And the minute you deny that God, you deny systematic theology. This is why systematic theology really does not exist outside of the Reformed community in other areas. While they maintain the term, they are busy denying it. Now let us have an example of that. You see, where you have only a world of brute factuality, you have no decree, no law, only chance. As a result, there is no propositional truth, no system in a world of chance. You cannot have systematic theology. Now, let us examine how this works out very practically. In 1943, a very brilliant and distinguished Barbian, Joseph Haratunian, was inducted into the chair of systematic theology at McCormick Theological Seminary, the Northern Presbyterian Seminary in Chicago. Now, like Bart, when you read Haratunian, it's sometimes a delight if you are not aware of his neo-orthodoxy, because I was a very young man the first time I picked up Bart, and here were these ringing statements about the virgin birth. Only as I read and reread, I realized he didn't believe a word of the virgin birth. It was not real history. And the same was true of the resurrection. And of course, well, this is not our subject now, the same is true of his God. And this is true of Joseph Haratunian. I'll put his name on the board because it is important. Some of the things he says are as brilliant a statement of the Reformed faith as you could hope to find, except it is said dialectically. Is God is a limiting concept. Now Scripture says, known unto God are all his works from the foundation or the beginning of the world, in Acts 15:18. Therefore you have a systematic theology. But when Joseph Haratunian, whom I knew, was, and I had a long discussion with him shortly after he was inducted into the chair at McCormick, walked the streets around the seminary for 2-3 hours, debating the issue and Van Til and a number of other things. When he was inducted into the chair, he gave a famous address published as First Essay in Reflective Theology, in which he denied the possibility of systematic theology. He said, and I quote, "Systematic theology, atheist science, has been dogmatic, for it has refused to subject the essence of religion to criticism. It has been speculative, because its rigorous deductions have not been open to genuine verification. And when not sure of its own rationality, it has turned mystical or pragmatic, thus insuring itself against intellectual criticism. And it has also been irrelevant, for no system does justice to the complexities of human life. Existence is commerce with contingency. An ethical decision is a leap from the unknown. Hence, the application of any system of theology to the infinite vicissitudes of life can be only partial and problematic. For these reasons, theology has earned a common reputation of pompous dullness. Now, I regret this as much as anyone here, and I promise you to do something about the matter. As a foretaste of my coming labors towards making theology a more illuminating and therefore a more interesting affair, I offer you the following reflections. The first step towards a non-boring theology consists in recognizing that systematic theology is an illusion." Unquote. Why is it an illusion? It's an illusion because the God of Scripture is an illusion. Now, Haratunian was more open and honest than Barth, who maintained the facade of systematic theology to deny systematic theology. St. Paul says of God's eternal decree, "And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are the called according to his purpose. For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son, that we might be the firstborn among many brethren. Moreover, whom he did predestinate, them he also called. And whom he called, them he also justified, and whom he justified, them he also glorified." For such a God, predestination is an inescapable consequence of his sovereign power in his creation. Systematics, then, is inescapable also. To eliminate predestination means to eliminate systematics and to have a God who is only an idea, or, to use their term, a limiting concept. And the God of Karl Barth, of Joseph Heratunian, of Paul Tillich, is a limiting concept. Now, listen to Heratunian. I'm quoting Heratunian because before Tillich and others came out, and Altizer, he was more honest about the implications of Barthianism. He says, the living God of the Bible defies literal statement. It is analogical insofar as God must be conceived in the likeness of life as we know it. The biblical man, whose reflection concerned existence and destiny and not intellectual objects, spoke of the mysterious intruder fittingly as the living God. The living, powerful, encountering, and acting God who is responsive to man and to whom man is responsible must be considered in analogy to a person. The living God is also metaphorical, a carryover, a projection from nature. God is not a thing among things and does not live in the likeness of the creature. If God is living, according to all that we know about life, he must have been born, and one day he will have to die. But the God of the Bible is eternal. Now, when he speaks of him as eternal, again, it's not in any sense that we know. It's because he's beyond all definition and beyond life. Therefore, he is living in a metaphorical sense. God is literally neither living nor non-living. Try to make sense out of that. The living God is thus a poetic expression. It is ambiguous, not in the sense of being vague or diffuse, but in that its signification is complex and inexhaustible. It is poetic, not in the sense of being fanciful, but in that it is imaginative, evoking an image which forbids identification with the real. In other words, he's eternal, but he's not real. He's living, but he's not living. The biblical mind, which recognized God as the creator of nature and not a thing in it, and was free from the sophisticated confusion between existence and pure thought, filled its discourses on God with images from nature, determined not to identify God with anything in heaven above or on earth below or in the sea. The image both affirms and denies its likeness to the imagined. The imagined is God. Therefore, biblical language is continually paradoxical. A paradox is a tension between thesis and antithesis, an affirmation and a denial. It is also two images in opposition, pointing to their harmony in God, such as the loving God and the wrathful God, which insists upon their reconciliation in the hidden God, pure Barthianism. A paradox in the Bible is truth which can only be perceived in the form of a contradiction bearing witness to its own superficiality. Hence, it constrains the mind to dig into its meaning with a promise of indefinite penetration and clear warning that the quest is endless and its goal beyond all intellection. Thus it is that the Bible remains a source of illimitable insight into existence and a whirlpool in which all systems are drawn into the mystery of God. Now, what happens when our science-possessed, system-making theologians set out to translate the language of the Bible into another which shall be free from symbol and metaphor, from the contamination of image and emotion, precise, literal, and unparadoxical? If they carry out the task they undertake, and we find our theological scientists consistently refusing to do so, their translations are in fact mistranslations. The living God of the Bible becomes the first cause or ultimate being or a value-producing factor in the universe or the principle of integration or an idea entity. Of course, the symbols, these expressions, enrich a living mind in its intercourse with God. but as translations of the living God, they are misrepresentations of biblical religion. The notion of the first cause has no content except if one smuggles some into it from the paradox-ridden world of experience. Ultimate being is another paradoxical notion, hovering between the idea of a being which turns God into an idol and the idea of being in general, which is the indefinable least common denominator of all being, unquote. I quoted this in length because here, in summary fashion, we have the major currents of modern theology set forth in this address. And when you grasp what Tertullian was saying, you begin to realize what modern theology is about. Incidentally, one of the finest books in modern theology is his Wisdom and Folly in Religion. It's beautiful reading. It's the kind of thing that you feel, well, every reformed person will agree with this, that, and the other, and some of the passages are really magnificent. But when he is saying it, it is prophetic language only in the sense that it is poetic. It's to stimulate a limiting concept to act on man. In other words, man projects it here so that it'll influence him better. But it isn't real. Now, in this long statement and other passages of Tertullian, we find first the denial that the term the living God, it has any meaning except as a metaphor. He says God is literally neither living nor non-living. If God is living according to all that we know about life, he must have been born, and one day he will have to die. Now, this is a very, very important statement. In other words, how does he understand the world and life and God in terms of man and nature? The only kind of life we know is created life, which is born and must die. Therefore, if God lives, he must have been born, and he will die. Now, this is anthropomorphism. You read God in terms of man, not man in terms of God. Whereas we must say God is a living God. He is uncreated being. And what we have derived from him is on a creaturely level, so we cannot understand God's life in terms of man's life. God does not derive life from our standards where it has a beginning and an end. Rather, it is our limited life that derives from his eternal standard. What Tertullian has done thus is to renounce theology for anthropology. The doctrine of God for the doctrine of man. And God is to be understood in terms of man. Now, this is total humanism. It is like the humanistic scientist who says, what my net does not catch is not fish. And if a fact doesn't meet my standard, it isn't a fact. Then second, Tertullian insists that the biblical mind was in some way, quote, free from the sophisticated confusion between existence and pure thought, unquote. Now, this is what we were dealing with last week. The idea that there can be no unity, no parallel between the world of brute facts and mind, there are two different things. Well, he says, this confusion between what's in my head and what I think I see there, and my idea in here in my head that my sense impressions have given me, that I have a classroom of students out here, well, that is a sophisticated confusion, he said, that the modern mind has invented. Now, of course, the whole idea that you are now out there and I'm just locked up inside of my skull is the sophisticated confusion of the modern mind, is it not? It never occurred to anybody until some philosophers thought about it. he's projecting the Kantian perspective back onto the Bible. And of course, that is absurd. For Heratunian, existence means the world of brute factuality, not the world of God's creation. Third, he insists in this passage we read that biblical language is continually paradoxical, not an actual description of reality. The only reality is that which is inside the autonomous mind of man. Biblical language, he says, is imagery. And he says the image both affirms and denies the likeness to the imagined. I like that because it's honest. The imagined is a good name for the God of modern theology. The imagined in capital letters. Now, a paradox has reference to dialectical concepts, and the Bible is not dialectical. Moreover, Heratunian says truth is beyond all intellection, beyond all thinking. All we have is the mystery of God. Something is out there. Maybe you're there, maybe you aren't. Maybe God is out there, maybe God is not. All we have is the mystery of God. And from my perspective, speaking in terms of Heratunian, you're a part of that big mystery. Whether you are or whether you are not is a question mark. Now, this is certainly not the world of the Bible. Then fourth, Heratunian says, we cannot speak of God as ultimate being without turning him into an idol, a fact, or a thing. In other words, theology cannot be scientific, a form of knowledge. It must cease to be systematic. It can only be poetic. And he says, and I will quote further, let us therefore call a halt to theology, which is hell-bent for science and the system. I deny that theology can be scientific, because God is not a thing among things. I deny that systematic theology is possible, because the paradoxes of the Christian faith signify the mystery of God, which resists inclusion in any system of nature. The time has come to do away with the error and arrogance of scientific theology and system making, and to break the stranglehold of a theological method which has far too long devitalized the mind of the church, unquote. Now, here is a classic statement of the arrogance of modern irrational man. It is modern irrational man who has devitalized the church, and he blames us of the Reformed faith for doing it. Did you know that we're responsible? Now, that's what Heratunian says. The Reformed believers who believe in systematic theology and a God who gives propositional truth, they are to blame. We Bardians are going to restore the church. Well, ever since they've taken over, the church has been doing a nosedive, has it not? Moreover, this mind is an irrational mind by its own willful desire. Everett W. Knight, in his book, Literature Considered as Philosophy, which would be well worth your reading in terms of this, has this to say, and I quote, the irrationality, despair, and so forth of modern thought resides precisely in its refusal to believe in the possibility of system, unquote. Now, Knight is not a Christian, but he has seen it. It's the rejection of systematics. It's insistence that the world cannot have anything but chance. It cannot be systematic. That is responsible, he says, for all the despair, the hopelessness, the meaninglessness of modern literature. It is simply reflecting the philosophy of our time. As a result, you have the idea of the absurd, the contrast between irrationality in the world and the rationality of man's reason. We dealt with Camus, C-A-M-U-S, and his very important book, The Rebel, which some of you may wish to consider in writing your paper. Now, in the myth of Sisyphus, Camus says further, the myth of Sisyphus, you remember, is the story of the Greek in Hades, whose punishment is totally meaninglessness in his assigned work, rolling a stone up to the top of the hill, and then it rolls back, and he has to go back again throughout all eternity, roll that stone up. That's the myth of Sisyphus. And he says, I said that the world is absurd, but I was too hasty. The world in itself is not reasonable. That is all that can be said. But what is absurd is the confrontation of this irrational and the wild longing for clarity whose call echoes in the human heart. The absurd depends as much on man as on the world. For the moment, it is all that links them together. It binds them one to the other, as only hatred can weld two creatures together. This is all I can discern clearly in this measureless universe where my adventure takes place. Unquote. Now, of course, before Camus in the last century, as men began to turn their backs on faith, this sense of meaninglessness, of total irrationality, began to possess men. And it was very interesting how it sprang up all at once. I was more than a little disgusted with myself recently when I realized that Tennyson's reference in his poem In Memoriam to the senselessness of nature, it's being a blind area of chance, red in tooth and claw, was not a product of Darwin. It came 10 years before. And the various books in social anthropology, which took an evolutionary perspective, were being written, all the main books, at the same time that Darwin was writing. How did it happen? They all came from the same epistemology. So at the same time, all these writers were converging on a radically evolutionary perspective in which the world was totally meaningless. So Bachofen, Morgan, Maine, and all the other anthropologists who were reducing the world to meaninglessness were doing it at the same time that Darwin was writing. It was not a product of Darwin, but they were all alike together, a product of the epistemology of modern philosophy. This also appeared about the same time in literature. One of the famous poems of the last century is Matthew Arnold's Dover Beach. How many of you are familiar with Dover Beach? Good. Now, Dover Beach sees this, and Matthew Arnold was deeply infected by the whole of the modern despair with regard to epistemology. In the concluding section of Dover Beach, Arnold wrote, as he writes of faith disappearing and unbelief, a world of chance possessing the mind of man. The sea of faith was once to it the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle pearl. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind. down the vast edges, near and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. For Arnold and others, there was still the hope that although the world is meaningless, let you and I be true to one another. But as irrational man pressed the claims of the absurd on life, he forsook all standards, all norms for a radically irrational lawlessness. Philosophically, it meant that men like Heidegger went a step further and separated thinking from reason. So that in Heidegger's philosophy, thinking has nothing to do with reason or logic. Irrationality went as far as it could go. Sartre said, man has only being, no essence. Hodanyik says, and I quote, every man is a tabula rasa. He is nothing that can be defined beforehand, but must define itself through life, unquote. The result, of course, has been that as a result of this modern epistemology and its insistence on the total irrationality and meaninglessness of the world, you have a return to barbarism, the studied irrationality, and what police call purposeless crime. Purposeless crime. People killing, robbing, for no motive other than the desire to destroy law, to lash out at order because of a radical hatred of everything that it represents. Now, in the modern literature, this is very, very plain. The modern writer exalts irrationality, whether it is in painting or in drama or in sculpture or in the novels, he exalts the irrational, the violent. For example, the dramatist of the avant-garde thinkers, Jean Tardot. According to Wellworth, in Tardot, the modern mind, the mind, that is, of the ordinary man in the street, craves irresponsibility and therefore willingly and uncritically, almost by now instinctively, abases itself before the first vague semblance of authority that it encounters, unquote. Modern man is portrayed as impotent and helpless, as wanting irresponsibility, as hating everything that smacks of law, as wanting to destroy the whole world of law and order. Then we have another dramatist, Eugene Ionesco. Of his character, Berenguer, it is written, and I quote, having no belief of his own. He represents a society that no longer has any right to defend itself against evil because it is not convinced that it is better than the evil opposing it, unquote. Now, how telling that is. In the last year, going back and forth across country, I have found more than one older person, say, for example, a doctor who said, I don't believe in abortion, but of course the world is changing. And how do I know that my standards are valid for today? Or parents who don't like it that their children are shacking up with some boy or girl. Well, it's not my way, but how do I know that what was good for me is necessarily good for them? In other words, the ability to defend oneself against evil is gone. Because the ability to differentiate between good and evil is gone, or to say that good is better than evil. And so you have the growing impotence of modern man. His inability to defend himself from the flood tide of evil that is overwhelming society. And the result is a growing rebellion against the whole world of law and order. For example, in the plays of Alfred Jarry, a French avant-garde dramatist who died in 1907. I don't recommend them, by the way, by any means. First of all, they're very stupid reading, senseless. And second, what you will understand of them, I prefer that you didn't understand. Someone has said of Jarry's philosophy that it is comparable to a child's refusal to bow to bathroom training. And I think that's a good image. He is self-consciously a barbarian. Jarry himself says of Ubu Roy, his character, who's the hero of his Ubu cycle of plays, that he is, and I quote, an ignoble creature, which is why he is so like us all. He is really rather a spoiled child, unquote. Might be better to say he was a totally depraved child. Now, Jarry warred against realism in the theater in the name of the new standard of rebellion. And his thesis was that since life is a nightmare, a meaningless nightmare, what must be on the stage is a nightmare. So the more horrible it is, the closer it is to what there is that might be called truth, if the word can be used. But he developed the principle of rebellion in himself, also very logically. This we must say for these men. They are true to their faith. Would God we were as consistent. According to Wellworth, let me quote, Jarry's greatest gesture of rebellion, however, was his alcoholism. There can be little doubt that he deliberately drank himself to death. This is very true. He set out to kill himself. Not long after his arrival in Paris, he must have made up his mind to make the supreme rebellious gesture of suicide. He chose alcohol as his medium because it was slow, and because the immediate effects of the alcohol enabled him to carry on his eccentricities undisturbed by the restraints of his own personality. Alcohol freed him from himself temporarily. Eventually, it freed him permanently from the whole burden of life. In a way, it was a heroic death. This is a liberal writing. For it was a death for a cause. And probably it was not as pleasant a one as the casual drinker might suppose. It was certainly not an insane or unreasonable death. Rebellion, as Jarry saw it, was a quest for total freedom and a protest against the ultimate enslavement, which is death. Jarry chose to rebel against the ultimate by systematically destroying himself. In other words, God has an eternal decree. Well, I defy his decree. I institute my own decree, and I will institute my death to prove that I am God over my own life. Dostoevsky has one insane student, Kirillov, who does the same thing. The only way he can finally prove that he is God rather than the God of Scripture is to say, I will kill myself. I will assert my ultimate independence of him. Jari chose to rebel against the ultimate by systematically destroying himself. In this way, he conquered, paradoxically, for having consciously sentenced himself to death, having decided to control his own death, as it were, by deliberately bringing it on, he was able to be completely at liberty, completely contemptuous of all manifestations of social order during the period of life that was left to him, unquote. That's a good statement coming from someone who's on Ajari's side. Remember, we quoted someone of the modern school to the effect that God representing good, the only freedom for modern man in declaring his independence from God, was to affirm evil. Since God represents life, let us affirm death. The modern world thus is intensely suicidal. In other words, irrational man seeks an irrational end. As T.S. Lewis said in one of his poems, this is the way the world goes, not with a bang, but a whimper. Are there any questions now? Yes.
How do you see the Jesus movement today as it views systematic theology? Do you feel it's rebelling against systematics? How do you see it?
Yes, it has no systematics. It doesn't want systematics. It wants experience, you see. And the essence of the modern epistemology is that it substitutes human experience for the Word of God. Now, the Jesus movement says, we want the modern world view and Jesus too. So we're going to put it together as an experience. And that's why they're either going to outgrow the movement or they're going to go back to the world. Yes.
Are you familiar with Stan Kubrick's Clockwork Orange?
No, I missed that. There's so much like that that I've read that I figure I've got to limit myself on the amount of garbage I inspect. Yes, I'm aware that he is a part of this whole movement. What I've done is to go back to some of the earliest figures in it, like Jari and others, because there's an uncomplicated simplicity about their expression of it. But you are right, from all that I've heard, it's very much the same thing. Any other questions? Yes.
Would you say the zest was
Yes. Now, Dostoevsky, as I indicated, was not Christian in any of our evangelical reform sense. He was a man who began as himself a very radical student. A very radical student. In fact, he was sentenced to death for his part in revolutionary activities and spent some years in Siberia, during which time he reacted against his revolutionary thinking and became the most passionate champion of the Russian Orthodox Church and its theology. Now, if you're looking for the positive side in Dostoevsky, it's going to be painful. But in his critique of what the world was going to be like, he was the most prophetic writer of his day. And in a series of books, he really set forth the problem tremendously. In his Crime and Punishment, he portrays a radical student who decides that there is no God, there is no moral law, I can kill. I will pick someone who is no better than a human louse, and I will kill them. It will be a useful work. I'll rid society of somebody society is better off without, and I will demonstrate that it will not bother my conscience to do so. So he proceeds to commit this murder. And the consequence, of course, is that he finds that his conscience is troubling him. In the process, there's a very interesting contrast that he draws. He takes up with Sonia, a prostitute, who's just a girl who knows she's a sinner. And the thing that comes out, a girl who's a prostitute, because she knows a sinner, is morally superior to Raskolnikov, who says, "I am not a sinner," because she at least knows her place in God's world. And the whole of the book is how his sense of guilt pursues him. And ultimately, he comes to a faith when he's a prisoner. The thing that amused me, I read that as a student at the university, and the course in which we were studying crime and punishment, there were a number of students who shared this kind of thinking. One was a philosophy major. He since became a professor of philosophy, but he was so totally on Raskolnikov's side, and he said, "His thesis is right. I don't care what Dostoevsky does with it." And this one day, I was walking down the street, and he was just ahead of me, and he started around the corner, and he ducked back hastily. And I went up to him, and I said, "What's the trouble, Dick?" And he began to swear at Dostoevsky. He said, "There was a cop around the corner, and I've gotten so identified with Raskolnikov, I felt guilty of murder, and I ducked from that cop." He said, "I'm going to drop that course. That book is no good." And he did. He actually quit the course. So, don't read it at any time if you have a bad conscience. Now, in his Brothers Karamazov, he carries this thesis forward too. And there is a section in it that I commend to you. You will find it published separately. The Grand Inquisitor. The Grand Inquisitor. You can find that published separately, and you can read it at a sitting, in which it speaks of Christ returning to the earth in the Middle Ages and walking down a street, I believe, of Spain. And he's immediately arrested. And the Grand Inquisitor, a cardinal, has him brought to him, and he knows who he is. He says, "Why have you done this? Why have you come back and messed up everything? We were doing so much good in your name. You want people to be free and to come, and you're putting it on the basis of character, when what man needs is slavery and controls, man-made controls, not from God, you see. And we were instituting it, and in your name, too." Now, that was aimed not only at the Catholic Church, but especially at the modern totalitarian state and its predestination. He's well worth reading if you realize that there are some totally non-Christian ideas there. But in The Possessed, he shows these students self-consciously thinking as atheists, as little gods who are going to use the fools, the naive Christians, the bureaucrats, and manipulate them as gods, and what the implications of their thinking are. It's not, it's rather grim reading, but it is important for you as a Christian to see what he had to say. There's another book that he wrote, which, while it's not particularly good reading, is important in that the title, Notes from Underground, is important in that there he says there's a new kind of man being born in the Western world, the underground man. So you have the underground press and the people who belong to it. And he says, what motivates the underground man? It is envy and hatred, and the desire to pull down and to destroy. And this is all he's capable of. Nothing more. To be envious and destructive. And he said the world is being taken over by ungodly men who are men from underground. They are like rats crawling out from the sewers. Their desire is to tear down and destroy civilization. And of course, his thesis over and over again, only as men who are possessed sit like the man who is possessed of the demons at the feet of Jesus is there any hope. So he's not consistent at all in his Christianity, and so defective that you might wonder, is he saved? It's an open question. But it is still important, yes.
I may have missed what you said, but it seems to me in the course of the lecture you talked about people who get to the point and say there can't be any consistency and everything's absolute chance. And today you seem to have gotten to a point where people set up a standard which is opposite our standard, just to defy us or God. And aren't they asserting the system and doing that, or is there any meaning in their system?
Yes, a very good question. Man being created in the image of God cannot escape some kind of system, you see. So that the Marxists have created an evil system. They cannot escape it. The Fabian socialists say we will not have a planned society. That's too much system. We will have a planning society, but they still get an order and a system in. Because man is created in the image of God, when he sets out to assert his independence of God and of system, he cannot do so. So while he denies system to God, he is sneaking it into himself as the new God. Very good point. Well, our time is up. If you'll remember your question until tomorrow. And tomorrow we'll deal with the death of God, its implications.
Authorized by the Chalcedon Foundation. Archived by the Mount Olive Tape Library. Digitized by ChristRules.com.